Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
You're listening to Escape Adulthood with Kim and Jason. It's May 28th, 2008, and this is show number 31. On today's show, we continue the second half of our two-part interview with Bob from Sesame Street. We ask him about his secrets of success and his favorite part about working on the show. We also talk about recess at work, a sweet chocolate calculator, and our favorite Sesame Street characters.
Take me back to when I was a child, when everything was good enough, it was good enough for the wild. Coyote sleeps in the moonlight, rabbit goes by the day, snake winds around on a hot afternoon, and eagle flies on his way. Take me back now if you can. Take me back now to the people sleep in the moonlight, the children run in the daylight, and that feeling never dies, but it may go away for a while.
Welcome to the Escape Adulthood Podcast, your number one source for long-lasting, fast-acting, physician-approved adultitis relief. This is Jason with my wife Kim saying hi from Studio 315 in Madison, Wisconsin. You can get in touch with us by sending an email to podcast@kimandjason.com. Or just give us a call at 608-554-0803. Well, we're officially into, I guess, summer. Is Memorial Day the beginning of summer? I know not officially on the calendar, but like people think
unofficially.
Of that.
Unofficially. We're unofficially into summer. And, yes, you can wear white now.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Oh, good. White.
I see your white pants.
Take out my
today.
White pants and yeah. White jeans and white shoes and.
Actually,
yeah.
We saw Will Smith on Ellen yesterday with white pants and white shoes.
Something tells me he can pull that off,
he
and
can.
I can't.
You are right.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's a beautiful day here in Madison, and this show we're gonna play the second half of our interview with Bob McGrath from Sesame Street.
Yep.
So we'll just get right into it with our mind bender. Okay, so we're sticking with kind of a Sesame Street theme here for our mind bender question.
Okay.
And the question is, what was Mr. Hooper's first name?
Ooh, Mr. Hooper. He always went by Mr. Hooper.
I know. And Mr. Hooper, now he had the little shop that he ran, right? He's the shopkeeper.
I don't think I've ever heard it, to be honest.
So. Want to throw out a guess?
Okay. How about Fred?
Fred. Okay. Fred. Kim's officially going with Fred Hooper as the name of the Sesame Street character. We will reveal the answer at the end of the show. As always, we like to remind you that if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, on how we can make the show better, what you like about it, we'd always love to hear it. You can send us an email at podcast@kimandjason.com, and that'll go to both of us. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 608-554-0803. You'll be able to leave a message, and we may just play it on the show. Plus, if you want to help us out, you can review us in iTunes. Go to the iTunes Music Store, type in Escape Adulthood. You'll find our podcast. We always appreciate good reviews. If you're going to write something mean, just write it on a piece of paper and crumple it up and then throw it away, right?
That's a good just life lesson.
Yeah. That's.
If
that's,
you can't say something nice, don't yeah. say it at all.
But if you, no, seriously, if you have something no. you want to, if you think would make
feedback,
the show better,
yeah.
we'd always love to hear it. So please do so.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Hello, Americans. This is Paul Harvey. Stand by for news.
Good evening. Here is the news for Palace.
I look good. I mean, really good.
Hey, everyone! Come and see how good I look!
Okay, Kim, what do we have on the news front today?
All right, I have an article from last summer from Arizona Daily Star by Becky Palak. Fun on the job. Recess at workday costs little and may pay off in profits. Wish your boss would focus less on net profits and more, say, on a volleyball net? Thursday could be your day if you could get your boss to recognize Recess at Work Day. Now in its fourth year, Recess at Work Day is the brainchild of Rich DiGirolamo of Wolcott, Connecticut. In a phone interview, he said workers deserve to have some fun. Workers have been beat up, he said. They're asked to do less or do more with less, and they're watching their jobs go away. All I'm suggesting is to take a little break. DiGirolamo, who speaks professionally on workplace topics, said recognizing employees on Recess at Workday improves morale and productivity. Plus, it's cheap. Bringing in ice cream and hula hoops or a volleyball net won't hurt the bottom line. If employers want to improve the morale of their workers, they should treat them with dignity and respect. He warns that this can't be a one-time thing. Employee morale is something employers need to address on a regular basis, showing people that their efforts and their hard work really do matter, DiGirolamo said. Organizations that are on board with this idea do something once a month or two, he said. Here's how a Tucson business has bought into the fun at work culture. The Chamberlain Group has about 200 employees. They say work life can get stressful at the company's tech support call center and garage door opener distribution center, so workers can get a weekly massage from a vendor who brings in a portable massage chair. Relaxed employees are more productive, says Anita Orzgoko, human resources manager. The group also has an employee spirit team that plans fun diversions for the whole staff. Next week is beach party week, with food, a water balloon toss, and a dress code that allows for shorts. There's any number of goofy things, she said, and we try not to take it too serious. The company also has a fierce competition running among several softball teams that fight for the coveted trophy at the annual company picnic, she said. I've never done any formal research on it, but there's definitely a connection between higher morale and more productive, more engaged employees. I think the best thing it does for the company is it allows the employees to loosen up a little. So that's just one example, but the article actually has a couple examples of companies who are interjecting this fun into the workplace and kind of sharing some examples of how that kind of boosts the morale of their employees.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think the key in that, it said the group also has an employee spirit team.
Yeah.
So it's built into the culture. I think there's probably a lot of cynics that would say, well, just getting pizza for the company or putting up a volleyball net's not really going to help anything, and we need to focus on making money. And it's like, in that case, they're right, because that's, you know, it's kind of like putting a, you know, Band-Aid on a something that needs about 85 million stitches. So
right.
It really needs to come from the top down and to have a sort of culture built into it, I think.
Mm-hmm. And having that team that's kind of always thinking about it and saying, how can we bring fun in this month and next month, and kind of keeps that ongoing respect that they talked about earlier in the article.
Right. And it's funny because we know Rich quite well. He's done some things for our magazine in the past. And I'm sure he deals with a lot of the things we do, where some of this talk of having more fun and being more playful comes across as very superficial and fluffy. And it really is, unless you build it in. But if you build it into your actual culture, I mean, if you look at Southwest Airlines as a good example, you will definitely see big time improvements to the bottom line and things like that. So if you really are serious about it, we totally recommend building it in, doing the little things, maybe forming a committee to get some ideas going so that people know that you're serious about that sort of thing. And in the meantime, when is Recess at Work?
Yes, it's every year on June 19th. It's actually coming up here in a couple weeks.
Yeah, so that's very timely. So at the very least, start with Recess at Work Day, June 19th, and who knows, maybe something bigger will stem from that, and you can maybe spearhead a campaign have a committee going full-time to figure out how we can have more fun in the workplace. Well, now we're going to get to, part two of the two-part interview we had with Bob McGrath, who is from Sesame Street. He doesn't really need an introduction, does he? If you've watched
Sesame Street, you know Bob.
He's the music teacher there, and he's been working since day one on Sesame Street. And he told us in the last interview, you know, how he first got called and he didn't really think much of it, thought it was kind of a dumb thing, you know. And then once he got to know Jim Henson and saw what they really wanted to do, he really kind of embraced it full time. And so he shared last time a lot of neat things, little stories and anecdotes about himself growing up and what it's like working for Sesame Street. And so we just continue the interview. We pick off right where we left off, asking about some of his favorite parts about working on the show.
Out of everything, like, what would you say was your favorite, has been your favorite part of working on Sesame Street?
Let's see. It's an awful, I guess, probably, maybe there's several things. There's no one thing. I think maybe working with really creative writers and puppeteers and the cast, and, you know, I often ask, do you really get along? And I have to say, the cast really is like a family. We actually get along exactly off camera, maybe even better than our roles on camera.
Wow.
We've been very, very good friends for almost 40 years, and I think everyone has great respect. We each bring something hopefully different to the show, and I think there's just a tremendous respect between all of the cast members for what the other member does. That's been very rewarding, and also I think we mentioned earlier about the feedback from parents about the shows, what has meant in their life and the lives of their kids, especially for kids who grew, as I said, grew up in inner city stories. A few years ago, I was in Newark Airport running for a plane, and I heard this voice say, "Yo, Bob," you know, and I looked over, and there was this very attractive African-American girl behind the American airline counter, and so I went over, had a few minutes, and said, "Hi," and we got talking, and so she was saying how great the show was and what it meant, and so sort of kiddingly, offhanded, and not too seriously, I said, "So I suppose it changed your whole life, right, you know, being a little bit fresh," and she got serious and said, "Yeah, it certainly did," and it turned out, she told me this long story, which I'll cut to the quick, but she had basically grown up in just a terrible project in Newark. No one in her family had ever graduated from high school, let alone go to college, and there was a great deal of crime in her neighborhood, and she said she remembers at a very early age, maybe 4 or 5, 6, of watching the show, and she said, I said to myself, I don't care what it takes, I'm going to get out of this neighborhood and be able to live in a neighborhood like Sesame Street.
Aww.
And so she not only finished high school, but she got a full 4-year scholarship to Rutgers.
Wow.
And has a pretty top executive job at American Airlines right now. So, you know, for every one of those stories you hear, you know there's probably several more that that have followed that same path. So that's probably one of my favorite parts of knowing, you know, what the show has accomplished and just being a strong part of it. Sometimes, you know, I'll have folks of all different ethnic backgrounds, you know, big guys give me a hug and say, you know, you're my surrogate father, and, you know, those kind of things. So very rewarding.
That's cool.
And I just feel incredibly fortunate to have bumped into this thing in my life.
So it kind of ties in good, and it sort of lessons that have been incorporated in the Sesame Street all along, but what would you say to someone who maybe has big dreams, maybe they're in a place where they want to be something greater or do something else? What would you say to them if they have these big aspirations but they don't quite know how to get there?
Well, I've been asked that a lot, and it's kind of a... it's kind of a hard question to answer to anybody. I always feel like I'm shortchanging them, but in a sense, there's not a whole lot you can tell them, because no two people are going to approach, you know, their life and where they hope to go in the same way. A lot depends on their personality. A lot depends on how much energy they put into whatever they hope to be doing, and so forth. In my case, I guess I'd say, you know, being absolutely as well prepared as you possibly can, and that's kind of an open, broad statement, but looking back, certainly all of the performing that I did as a very early age was helpful. Certainly, all my formal training at the University of Michigan, getting an undergraduate and graduate degrees at Manhattan School of Music, those were all long preparation years. And while no one has ever asked me for a degree to show my degree's papers, all of that was very important. So I don't think you can shortchange that amount of work that goes into preparing for a career. I worked with a very wonderful voice coach. He was from Juilliard School of Music, and it was just about the time that I got the Mitch Miller Show, and I was then working with him to be an evangelist in all the St. Matthew and St. John Passions and all those that kind of repertoire. And I said, I just got this great show, singing along with 25 guys. I said, yeah, I'm so lucky. And in his wonderful Viennese accent, he said, luck has very little to do with this. And he said, basically, it's because you were prepared. And he said, it may have been a little luck that you had a chance to audition or that situation came about to perform. But he said, you know, if you didn't deliver at that point, he said there'd be 50 people lined up around the block waiting to take that job. So yeah. I think that's really important. I think you have to be as I have to talk only in my own case because that's the only life I know.
Sure.
But I think it's important to be as flexible as you possibly can. In my case, I had a chance through college and all kinds of performing in the Army in Germany to do all kinds of music, from everything from classical to rock and roll. And so those first several years in New York, when I was doing a lot of freelancing before I got with the Mitch Miller Show and ultimately Japan and then ultimately Sesame Street, which are more steady kinds of things, I was sometimes doing 3 and 4 jobs a day, everything from singing a Gregorian chant Requiem in the morning to a rock and roll date at night with a recording by Stravinsky in a choral group in the meantime. That was one particular day.
Wow.
It was quite a wide range. But all of that early work doing a lot of different kinds of things kept me alive, and I never waited a table or washed a dish in my life except at home and in college. So I was always able to make a living doing that. I think you have to be willing to be of the temperament to take failure and understand that's part of the game. At one point I was trying to do, I did a number of commercials both on and off camera, and you'd average about 20 or 25 or 30 auditions for every one that you might get. That's pretty common. And especially for... And I did a little auditioning for Broadway, although it was never a really driving... I did summer stock and that kind of thing, but I never had a great desire that I wanted to be a Broadway star necessarily, partially because I had a light lyric voice, and at that time no one was amplified. Now it would be very much easier. Mm-hmm. But I never had much luck doing that sort of thing, and sometimes, you know, you can get very discouraged at that sort of thing, and sometimes very often it has very little to do with your talent or who you are. They may just be looking for someone that's 2 inches taller or shorter than yourself, you know.
Yeah.
Leslie Uggams was with us on Sesame Street. I always felt she had probably one of the best temperaments for being in show business. She had a great positive attitude about everything she did, and was willing to accept the kind of music that Mitch asked her to sing, even though she may have wanted to do some other kinds of songs at the time. So that, and also, you know, if they're coming to New York, I mean, certain professions in the business I think are harder. I think acting is incredibly difficult. Not that I've ever tried to be necessarily a full-time actor as opposed to television person and singer, but I think that's very, very hard, and they should probably have, you know, enough resources to stay alive without making any money in what they hope to do for a year or more, so you're not just coming in and getting very discouraged, because being in New York not having a job can be very discouraging.
Yeah.
I've been a freelancer all my life, and I've always been kind of willing to go with that flexibility, but it's very hard. I guess bottom line, though, you really have to be tremendously passionate about what you want to do, and extremely dedicated, and be willing to work as hard as you can, but probably at some point also have the reality that if this doesn't work out, because it's incredibly competitive, you should have some backup. And in my case, I decided to get my degrees, my graduate degrees and so forth. And I did teach for part-time while I was getting a master's at a private boys' school in New York, which I enjoyed immensely. And I knew that I could always have continued teaching and would have enjoyed that and probably done, you know, some singing. But, you know, I had no idea if I was going to be able to make a living singing when I first came to New York. That was to be determined. Hmm. So kind of have some backup. And especially in the arts, it would be very wise to have some additional kind of skill to fall back on, I think.
Because,
you know, how many cartoonists make it into a strip?
Not very many, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
the odds are not with like, you.
It's
like
really,
how many are going to be astronauts in reality?
Yeah.
Right.
It's really great to have that snapshot you just gave, because it's, I think anytime anyone has a certain level of success, the people that don't know them very well are just from the outside, you know, they look at it, oh, they're so lucky, or must be nice, and things like that. And, you know, I don't really think there really are too many overnight sensations. They take a long time. And and I think what you said really sums up that old line of luck is really when preparation meets opportunity. So
absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
So that's really
that's
great.
Very well said.
To hear that of all the stuff that you'd been through and the different things you had to be flexible with, and it's really great inspiration. I think that is more realistic for people to hear of how you get to where you are, because it's not really a magic formula necessarily. It's just hanging in there.
And it's probably not exclusive at all to people in the entertainment business. I mean, there may be, if you train to be a doctor or dentist or lawyer, you probably know you're going to have, you know, a profession to go to, but certainly in the arts, that's not true. I mean, you really don't know if you're going to. And the other thing is that a lot of people feel that unless you're a star, you've not been a success, but there are just thousands of musicians working that people have never heard of that have recording dates, you know, and spend their whole life in a recording studios making a very good living, and they've never, ever heard of them. So, but on the other hand, all those people have worked since they were 6 years old learning their instrument. You know? There's very few overnight sensational successes, I think.
Yeah.
Now, this is kind of off the subject, but before we go to our last question, I have a little side question for you. A couple days ago, we were at a speaking engagement. We told someone that we were going to be interviewing you, and she said, oh, you know, I've been to one of his concerts, and it was so cool because at a certain point, you know, Bob had all the kids stand on their chairs, and because I don't know how she worded it, like, you know, you can't see very good, so stand on your chairs. And she said, the people like that were running the staff were like, oh no, you know, but she said it was the coolest thing.
I don't remember that, but probably foolish advice if they fell off, you know, the whole place would have been sued, right? That's funny.
But that was what she remembered. She's like, that was just so cool, and the kids just felt so big and important.
Oh, isn't that funny?
Yeah.
I was probably warned afterwards never to do that again, because I don't recall ever doing that again. That's that. Funny.
Yeah.
I now going around the country, I run into kids and say, oh, I was six and I was one of the people in your neighborhood. And I run into musicians in major symphony orchestras and said, you know, we were down at Disney with you in the All-American College Orchestra and we played there, and now we're in the Philharmonic of this and that. And it's kind of fun to bump into these kids all the time saying they did this or that when they were little.
That's
cool. That's
fun. You were a part of so many people's lives, you know. It's kind of an interesting thing because you don't know them, but
That's right. I had a funny letter one time from a little girl, and you have to sort of think back where her logic was coming from. But she wrote me this letter saying she liked the show and da da da, and she said, oh, and by the way, my cat just had her kittens. So what you can imagine is that, you know, she was holding up this pregnant cat in front of the TV set, showing them to me. Because kids always felt we could see them like they could see us, right?
Yeah.
And I've been asked by kids, you know, how'd you get out of that little box? You know? Fred Rogers was also asked that one time. I heard a little quote by him, and he gave this long, wonderful Mr. Rogers explanation of the electronics of the whole thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as he was walking away, the kid yelled, he said, "Well, how are you going to get back in?" So much for that explanation, right?
Yeah.
But I have to tell you one quicker, because it's sort of the same thing. One time standing down at Disney, I was working and I had my kids with me. We were standing in line for a long time for the Small World event. Mm-hmm. We just took our grandchildren down there a couple months ago. And, you know, you stand in line for a long time. And this family ahead of me, a husband and wife, and they had three kids, two of them like 6, 7, 8 or so. And then this one like three-year-old little girl. And the closer she got to this da-da-da-da-da, the more she knew she didn't want to go in.
Oh,
and
no.
She was just screaming her head off. And they were beside themselves. No one had turned around and recognized me or said hello to the parents. And so at one point, the father put this little screaming three-year-old, up over his shoulder. So we're face-to-face, like, you know, 6 inches apart, standing in line, screaming in my face. And I thought, maybe I can do my good deed for the day. So I whispered in her ear, I said, "You're going to love this ride. It's Big Bird's favorite ride."
Uh-huh.
And she stopped long enough to stare me in the face, stopped crying, and said, "I don't care if you are on TV." Screamed twice as loud, so she knew who I was the whole time and just didn't want me any part of her life for telling her. And the funny part was the parents never heard any part of this discussion or dialogue. It was just simply between she and I. And some of those things just totally cracked me up. I mean, I wanted to fall down on the ground laughing.
Sometimes star power doesn't have much power, does it?
So as impressive as I was, a little girl standing on the seat, I was just that unimpressive it's been a wonderful life, I'll tell you.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, could I convince you to sing part of the "Who Are the People in Your Neighborhood"? I know you sang a little bit before, and my eyes lit up. So.
Oh, I guess I could. Yes. Let's see. Because Kim and Jason are the people in your neighborhood, in your neighborhood, in your neighborhood, and the artist is the person in your neighborhood. They're the people that you meet when you're walking down the street. The people that you meet each day.
Yay.
Oh, and following, I have to tell you one other thing that constantly brings a smile to my face. Back to an earlier question, about, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago, we did a nighttime special, and we did a spoof on that, on this nighttime for adult special, with Martina Navratilova, Barbara Walters, and Ralph Nader.
Okay.
And they were all in the song with me, and each one had a humorous little bit to do with me. And Barbara Walters was trying to get the inside scoop on Linda and myself, the deaf girl, right? And, you know, "What's really happening with you and Linda?" And I said, "Well, we're going out for a walk in the park, and we're coming back to our apartment." And she said, "Yes." And I said, "They were going to have a really great game of chess." And she turned to the camera and said, "This is what you call a really slow news day on Sesame Street." But the funny one was Ralph Nader. And he had a little wagon upside down testing the wheels. And I said, "What are you doing? What's it?" And he said, "Well, I'm testing this wheel to make sure it's safe." I said, "That's pretty nice." He said, "Well, that's my job." And I had a sweater on, and it was a breakaway fixed sweater. And he said, "Nice sweater." I said, "My Aunt Matilda knitted it." And he said, "Well, is it safe?" And I said, "I don't know. I suppose so." And he said, "Well, better safe than sorry." So he pulls up my sleeve and my buttons, and the whole thing falls apart.
Oh, no.
So, and he said, your Aunt Matilda knitted you a lemon, you know, because he was into raiding cars at that point. But the funny part that, I mean, that was funny, but what I thought was ludicrous was that he had come to the studio an hour or two earlier before the taping, and he had never looked at the song they had sent him to learn so he could sing. Because the consumer advocate's a person in your neighborhood. So I had to sit in a little room, my dressing room, with Ralph Nader, teaching him to sing "The Consumer Advocate's a Person in Your Neighborhood." And
that's a mouthful.
That's got to be one of the sillier things, other than singing Danny Boy to the Prime Minister, that I've ever had to do in my life. And then had a big sold-out performance at Carnegie Hall as a tribute to Harry Chapin. Do you know that name, Harry Chapin?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are good friends, and they did a – when he – was, you know, killed at a very early age in an automobile accident. They did a huge tribute at Carnegie Hall, and everybody was there. I mean, from Bruce Springsteen to the Smothers Brothers to Belafonte and on up and down. And we were all together in one really small room, and Ralph Nader was there. And he sort of stood out even among all of these great stars. And so we were sitting there with Bruce Springsteen and Paul Simon and the whole thing, and he said, you know, I just did a really great thing on Sesame Street a couple of weeks ago. And they said, really, what? And he said, well, I sang with Bob and the people in the neighborhood. Aww. And he said maybe they'd like to hear it. And I said, no, that's probably all right. But so we proceeded to sing the Consumer Advocates to all of these major stars, and I thought, oh, my God. You know.
They probably loved it.
Yeah.
They did love it.
I bet.
But I was just a little embarrassed doing that song for all those folks.
That's a great story.
Oh, God, it's been a funny, fun life.
That's
great. Well, I can imagine it certainly when you were – 5-year-old little boy, you had no clue whatsoever of what your life would end up being. But we always ask everyone we interview at the very end, what did they want to be when they grew up? So I'm very curious to hear when you were 5 or 6, what was going through your mind as your big dream?
Well, I have been asked that once before, and I never really thought about it until somebody asked me the question. Because, you know, I grew up on a farm, and I think even though I milked all the cows and did my chores and did all of that stuff, I mean, I was pretty sure I didn't want to be a farmer. I knew
okay.
It was really hard work, and somehow that didn't seem so exciting, nor did it to my older brother, as I mentioned earlier. And then I was thinking, you know, when I'm thinking now of our kids here, and I have grandchildren living in New York, and I grew up in a much, much simpler time. Not only the fact that I was living on a farm and with, you know, a creek running through and all kinds of great stuff and my border collie Lassie and the whole that
yeah.
kind of a thing. There really wasn't the pressure that kids have today, making sure that you get into the best kindergarten so you can get into the best Ivy League college. You know, it's getting a little ridiculous. But and also I was, you know, I was around 10 during the big World War II, and the country was totally absorbed in that whole thing. Everything, I remember as a 9, 10, 11-year-old, stripping and collecting tinfoil from chewing gum wrappers and rolling it into a ball and depositing it someplace to make gosh knows what, you know. Maybe it was more of a psychological thing than actually being useful. And I was selling war bonds, and I was always very busy doing what I was doing at the time. I was very influenced, I think, by my 10-year-old brother who was in the Air Force, and he was in a B-17, and that was pretty influential. I think he was kind of a role model. He went to University of Illinois and became an engineer, and pretty much through high school, I thought that's probably what I should do because he did it, and he was having a successful life and everything. Even though I'd been singing that whole time, preparing for what I was ultimately going to do, I don't think I really understood through all of those, you know, many years of singing and performing that this is what I was actually going to end up doing the rest of my life. And I was all signed up to go to the University of Illinois as an engineer when I won about a 2 or 3 week scholarship to a music camp outside Chicago at the old J. Ogden Armour Estate. And there were a lot of professors and music people from the conservatory and Northwestern there. And it was at that time that they said, you know, we did a lot of music, and they said, you really ought to give music a chance because you have some talent and a good voice, et cetera, et cetera. And that's when I did a 180-degree turn and decided to go to the University of Michigan along with a good friend of mine, who they squeezed me in because I was like 6 months late applying for admission. And fortunately, my best friend's father was a fraternity brother of the dean of admissions, so, you know, he picked up the phone and got me in. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I never would have gotten in because I was so late. So, I know you've quoted in your book, you know, if you want to hear God laugh, tell him your plans. It's an old saying, but that has a lot to do with my life. I mean, I kind of just went where it seemed the logical place to go at that time. And I guess when I was a child and singing, and my mother was the prompt for all of that, I guess I didn't dislike it, and I don't honestly know how much I did like it, but I think I probably enjoyed it. I didn't dislike it, and it was kind of fun winning contests and doing all that kind of thing. And It wasn't like my 5-year-old grandson, who is just a total fireman at this point. He's just totally, he knows everything one can know about a fireman. He's got all the equipment. All the firemen in town know him because he goes down and he spends time. So, you know, if you ask him right now, he'd say, I'm going to be a fireman. That's a tough profession. I'm not sure I'd be happy if he is. It's a tough one and a dangerous one.
Yeah.
But I guess I kind of ambled along in life just seeing, you know, what felt right at the time. And doing music felt right at that time. It felt good when I was preparing all through college. I guess by the time I finally got into college and had encouragement from my voice teachers, one who had a very successful singing career in New York on radio, Philip Dewey, and he said, you'll never have any trouble working in New York because there's always room for a good top tenor. Where that was going to lead, I didn't know, but that was pretty encouraging, even though I knew the operatic work, which I had to do there, probably wasn't going to be my life work. So, and then, as I said, just freelancing every possible kind of thing, musical, in New York when I got there, and seeing what worked out. So that's kind of been what I've done. I never expected to be in Japan. I never expected to be on Sesame Street, but things seem to flow along in a kind of a natural way. Many things didn't work out, but not a whole lot, quite frankly. So I don't have that. I don't think I ever had that great aspiration that I've got to be this when I grow up,
which is
probably a reckless thing way to grow up.
I think there's a lot of good message in there, just like following what makes sense at the time and what you're interested in, and that's.
Yeah, I kind of always, and my life is that way right now. I have, like, you know, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 projects all kind of juggling and going at the same time. Now I'm much more into, and it's been a gradual transition. The Sesame Street brought me into all of my live performing that made that possible to do thousands of concerts with, you know, I think over 110 or 15 different symphony orchestras at this point.
Wow.
I never would have thought of being able to do that. But that happened as a result of Sesame, as a result of Sesame and their connection with NAMM, the International Music Product Association, and MENC, which represents about 70 or 80,000 music teachers, educators around the country. I'm much, much more into early childhood music education and doing a lot of national conventions and keynotes and workshops, and I'm doing one on Monday at the Sony building for about 100 teachers from the New York Archdiocese, the Catholic Archdiocese, helping them bring music in a little more in depth than just sitting around and singing a song, and have some product now that ties literacy skills to music. So one thing just sort of feeds off another. My work with NAMM now, that's this product. I mean, you know, I'm already signed up to be riding on the Rose Bowl float for them again next year. They sponsor the Sesame Street float. I've done that 4 or 5 times. And everything sort of spins off from one thing to another, it seems, these days.
That's
Jimmy
cool.
Stewart had a great line. It was someone who was a friend of his, and they said, what are you doing these days, Jimmy? He said, this was later in his life, and he said, well, he said, I seem mostly be going around and collecting awards. I seem to be, you know, that's happening to me more and more frequently, and every time I get one, I think of Jimmy Stewart saying, I'll just go around, seem to be getting more awards.
Well, then you know your life was very meaningful
yeah.
if everybody wants to award you, you know?
Well, sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes it's just to get a crowd, you know, or something. I don't know. No. I could be cynical if I wanted to. No, most of them have been just wonderful, but there's a certain reality. You have to look at all these things, you know, like the little girl says up close, you know, it's too good, you know. You have to look at life in a pretty realistic way. Yeah.
Like, well, it sounds like God had great plans for you, and he continues to use you, and it's really inspiring to see all that, and you've been so generous with your time. We just want to thank you for taking the time out.
Yeah,
it's been a real treat to talk to you, Bob.
Well, likewise, and you mentioned God. Religion has been a big part of my life, and I think that's that's an important kind of foundation for at least for me in my life, and I think probably for a lot of people. So there's a lot of parts that go into a rewarding life.
Definitely.
A happy life, I think.
Yeah.
Well, it's obvious that you have one. So it's thank you for sharing so many great stories with us and so many smiles. And we just are really anxious to share this interview with our listeners. So.
Yeah. Well, not at all. And I loved reading a lot of the stories in your magazines. They're very inspirational and they're fun and they're clever and I think you know it gives insight to a lot of people. So
thank you.
Good luck in all of that, plus all of your work you do around the country. That's terrific.
Thanks, Bob.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, take care and it's great chatting with you.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Bob. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I don't know about you, but I could have talked to him for another couple hours.
Oh,
probably.
Definitely. This could have been like a 6-part interview.
Yeah. Just really neat to hear. I can remember one of the stories he was telling about, you know, just, you know, grown men coming up to him now and, you know, hugging him and, you know, kind of like he's a surrogate father. And just must be so many stories like that, which, you know, reminds me, obviously, someone like him, he has a platform, he's been on TV, but none of us really know how much we impact people. You know, sometimes we get a thank you note or sometimes we hear back from people, but no matter what line of work or wherever life leads you, you're always impacting way more people than you'll ever know. And so it's kind of just a good reminder to just keep that in mind and, you know, be nice to people. And it sounds so basic, Sesame Street, but smiling, being nice, listening, being polite, those sorts of things can go a long way, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. And I have to say, just having that experience of when he sang for us, mm-hmm. Oh, man, that goes down in history for me.
Yeah, it was really cool to just be able to I know, I was thinking it the whole time, and I didn't want to, like, ask him because I didn't want to be, like, a big nerd, but I'm glad that you had the courage had the courage to do it because it was pretty cool. So.
Yeah.
Today, one of these lucky contestants will win his or her weight in fish right here on
Wheel of Fish.
Oh, goody, goody. I've done a good thing, and I get a prize.
Well, we had a number of people that wrote in with their favorite Sesame Street characters from last month. That was our promotion. We were looking for who's your favorite Sesame Street character and why. And this one is the winner for this month. It's from Sarah F., and she wrote, "I loved Kermit." The thing about Kermit, he was on Sesame Street and The Muppet Show.
Yeah,
so he's a crossover favorite.
Yeah.
And she said, "I loved Kermit because he ran the whole gamut of emotions. He always seemed to be feeling blue just when I was, and it always made me feel as if somewhere in the world someone understood me. And he was a reporter, just like I always wanted to be." So it's interesting when you think about how those characters connect. Mm-hmm. I know... I liked Oscar the Grouch, the grumpiness side of things. But Guy Smiley was one of my favorite obscure characters. Who would you say would be your favorite?
I always like Mr. Snuffleupagus.
Snuffy.
Snuffy. And he was just always kind of, well, I don't know if I liked his size or... I know, he just seemed kind of like a big fluffy dog or something, you know?
Just kind of one of those loyal friends, too, with Big Bird,
yeah,
right? You know,
yep.
Just kind of one of those friends that everyone would like to have. So, but even as we're talking about Mr. Hooper and some of the live-action characters, you know, I remember Lewis and Maria and Gordon and, of course, Bob. And they really made the characters really believable and... Just a lot of fun. So anyway, Sarah, we will get you out a $20 gift certificate to the Kim and Jason Lemonade Stand. Thank you, everyone who submitted entries. For this month's promotion, we are asking, what is your favorite way to have fun at work? So tying into the recess at work, what is your favorite way to have fun? Just send us an email, at podcast@kimandjason.com, or you can give us a call and leave us a message there, 608-554-0803. And again, the winner that we choose next month will win a $20 gift certificate to the Kim and Jason Lemonade Stand.
Welcome to kimandjason.com.
And now, here with an unlimited supply of misinformation is Mr. Know-It-All.
Okay, K&J update. We recently had our second escape event for Club K&J members. And if you missed the first one and not sure what they were or what an escape event is, it's basically a day where we pick a certain day on the calendar and all of us, you know, Club K&J members get together and do something childlike on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
And for our second event, it was called Do-Re-Mi. Do something...
You just had to do something music-related.
Yeah.
Some way, shape, or form.
And it was very open-ended, so it was kind of neat to see what kind of things people came up with. Our grand prize winner was Judy Irene from California, I believe she's from. And she went all out, okay? Now, this was hers was a good example of that you don't have to play a musical instrument or, you know, have vocal talents to really do something music-related. Because she basically... tied in the infamous, or not infamous, but the famous song.
Right.
I'm using that word wrong. Take me out to the ball game. And she went to a ball game, and she had took all these pictures of her and her family having fun and kind of intertwined it into the song and made a little YouTube video.
Yeah. Got to formulate her, or portray her love of the San Francisco Giants as well. She's a big fan. And it was a neat little slideshow with even her cat
made
some appearances.
Yeah, she had some different signs and all sorts of fun things. So if you haven't checked out the video, please, you know, get on the blog and check it out. It's a lot of fun. But we had some other neat ones, too. Walt brought or sent in some pictures of him resurrecting some old accordion days that he remembered when he was young. He had to take accordion lessons, and so he kind of brought that out, dusted it off, and had some fun with that.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the other ones?
Had Sue. The other finalist was Sue, where she is a sign language interpreter.
Oh, right.
And so she did a song in sign.
Yeah.
And did a little video of that. So that was pretty cool as well. So yeah, those were our finalists, but Judy came away. She was voted to be the winner, and for her effort, she won an iPod Shuffle.
Yeah.
And she picked a red one, so we shipped that out to her. And we actually have another escape event coming up this month in June here, so more details will follow. And they're really geared around Club K&J, which I guess is a good segue, that we reveal all the details for upcoming escape events to Club K&J members. And we've made kind of a new transition with Club K&J, where it is now, instead of being an annual fee, we've changed it to monthly. And it's only $4.95 a month. And what I think is cool about that is then it gives people a chance to, like, try it out, because you can unsubscribe at any time. Some of the major benefits of being a Club K&J member, of course, are being privy to all of the behind-the-scenes stuff, things like these escape events and that sort of thing. But also you get a 25% discount to the lemonade stand. We mail out paper versions of our Kim and Jason magazine to our members.
Yep.
You get a cool T-shirt when you sign up. We do all sorts of things, and we've got always new things in the works. And so it's kind of a neat way to be able to try it. Again, for $4.95 a month, it's, you know, some people, you know, buy Starbucks, costs $5,
definitely.
You know, a day.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a neat way to get in, and we're excited to announce that change as well. So if you are one of those people who are serious about not taking yourself too seriously, Club K&J is the place for you. You can check it out. $4.95 a month. We're always having a lot of fun. We hope you'll think about joining.
There it is. The holy grail of Christmas gifts, the Red Ryder 200-shot range model air rifle.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
That is so cool.
Cool.
Oh, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
our cool thing for this show kind of ties in with having more fun at work. And we all know that most of us have jobs that at one point or another you're going to have to pull out the calculator and do some number crunching. Some more than others, some days more than others. But we have on our store, Kim and Jason Lemonade Stand, a new calculator that will definitely add a smile to your face when you have to punch some numbers and figure some things out. It looks almost exactly like a Hershey bar, okay?
It's not a chocolate bar.
A chocolate bar. It's not Hershey branded, but it looks like one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any, you know, desire for adding a little sweetness to your desk, then this would be perfect because it seriously looks like a candy bar. And, you know, when we actually got them in, I was looking at them and kind of taking the wrapper on and off, and it literally has a wrapper.
The foil, the brown wrapper around it. And
the buttons are like the little pieces of chocolate. Mm-hmm. So, and it just, you have to at least check out the picture because it is just kind of crazy how accurate it looks. And you can't eat it, but...
Yeah, we should probably mention that it's not edible.
It is not edible.
But it doesn't melt either.
Right, right.
So that's good.
But just the fact of having that on your desk, or if someone important comes into your cube or office and says, okay, what were you thinking about this? You pull out your calculator, you're going to get a smile because if you don't take a bite out of it, someone else might, you know?
That's right.
Very, very fun.
You might want to have a little sign that next to it says,
please
do not
eat.
Yes. So. But it is totally one of the coolest, cool things that we currently have. Okay, the mind bender answer. What was Mr. Hooper's first name? We remember him as the character in Sesame Street, the older gentleman who ran the little shop.
Yeah.
And what you said, Fred.
I said Fred, but you know, I think I was kind of blending in Mr. Rogers, probably. Fred Rogers.
It's not a bad guess, though.
Okay.
The actual Mr. Hooper's first name is Harold.
Harold, okay.
Yes, which is actually my grandpa's name.
Yeah.
It wasn't revealed until episode number 871.
Oh my goodness.
Mr. Hooper gets his diploma, which aired on March 15th, 1976.
Huh.
So you were not even born when it was revealed.
True.
I was merely 1 month and 4 days old when Mr. Hooper's first name was revealed.
Did you catch that on the TV?
Yeah, I think it was on in the background. I have vague recollections. I was going to guess Harold or Howard, you know, but, you know,
yeah.
when you're 1 month old, your memory isn't always dependable. So,
yeah, true.
Also, I dug this up. This was interesting. And this sounds almost like unbelievably, like this can't possibly be true, but it says in 2004, Cookie Monster revealed what his name actually is.
What?
Before trying cookies for the first time, his name was Sid.
Sid?
Apparently, yeah.
What?
Now, I have to admit, I wasn't watching a lot of Sesame Street in 2004.
Hmm. No, I wasn't either.
But this is what it said. So Cookie Monster, his name before trying cookies was Sid.
Okay.
So there's another little tidbit you can impress your friends with.
Interesting.
What's up, Doc? Now, this won't hurt a bit.
Okay, so our prescription this week revolves around what we were talking about earlier with the recess at work.
Mm-hmm.
And Rich gives us some thoughts, some ideas. So here we go. The prescription is to pick one of these five ways to have fun at work and do it. So I'm going to give you five choices. Pick one. I don't care which one it is. Do it. This is your prescription. You can have a race with your office chairs.
Mm.
Take notes with crayons or colorful pens. Very simple, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mix up your meeting. Bring milk and cookies or go for a walk.
Mm.
Maybe you could have like a meeting at a park if it's nearby.
Yeah,
you know,
that'd be
or
cool.
Outside in the back, something
yeah.
like that. Host a picnic or barbecue, especially with the summer coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Or let workers who never call in sick play hooky for a day.
Oh, cool.
That'd be a good one if you're a boss. So
yeah.
Pick one of those five ways to have fun at work. Do it, and you will help fend off adultitis.
Well, that's it for today's show. Be sure to check out escapeadulthood.com for today's show notes, featuring links to some of the things we talked about here today. For Jason, this is Kim signing off from Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks for listening, and remember, it's never too late to have a second childhood.
It's a little childish and stupid, but then so is high school.